Hello and welcome to Sobre Mesa Podcast. My name is Owen Gilmartin, and today my guest is Leah Patton, a British Indian independent journalist based in Madrid, who's covered news, current affairs, and community stories from around Spain. Hey, Leah, good to talk with you.
Hi, Owen. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no, it's you've been doing, I think, a lot of coverage on this story we're going to talk about today, this week. So it's great to have you with us. I mean, this is a story we covered very briefly in our introduction in last week's episode, which is the fallout from the president of the Spanish Football Federation, his deeply inappropriate and quite possibly criminal offense during the World Cup, well, during the presentation of the World Cup after Spain won the trophy last Sunday. So we're talking about Rubiales and Rubiales' unconsensual kiss with Jenny Hermoso. Leah, you've been covering this a lot. I mean, I'm amazed he is still refusing to step down. This has now been we're into the second week of this. You know, we're 10, 12 days of him refusing, you know, a proper apology. It looked like he was going to step down last Thursday. It was pretty much announced. And then on the Friday in the Football Federation's meeting, he either did a U-turn or I don't know what. So maybe can you tell us what the basic outline of this story, maybe for people who haven't been following it that closely? Like we've had 12 days of polemic. It's completely overshadowed this wonderful sporting achievement by the Spanish women's football team, you know, to win the World Cup and then to have 12 days of this. So maybe could you give us an overview of this controversy and where we are now?
Sure. So, you've mentioned quite a lot of stuff. And basically, you know, just to start from the beginning, you know, within minutes of Rubiales' non-consensual kiss of Jenny Hermoso during the World Cup final medal ceremony, you know, 12, 13 days ago now, videos and images of the incident went viral, and the Spanish people began demanding his sacking. A few days later, he gave a very arrogant speech where he really let the mask slip on just how much his privilege has numbed his ability to distinguish between right and wrong. He refused to resign. He claimed that the kiss was consensual and just a little peck, quote unquote, and said demands for him to step down were like, quote unquote, a witch hunt. So, of course, this speech would later backfire on him quite spectacularly. And he's actually now he's gone silent. But Jenny Hermoso has also not been hugely visible in this situation, but she did come forward to strongly deny Rubiales' claim that she agreed to the kiss. And she said she felt vulnerable and a victim of an impulse-driven, sexist, out-of-place act. So the entire football team have shown their support for her by going on strike. And also most of the coach, Jorge Vilda's staff, have offered to resign too. Even the government are currently working to ensure that Rubiales no longer has a job running Spanish football. And as the weeks have progressed, his colleagues who were previously loyal to him have also begun distancing themselves from him. And also FIFA have suspended him, and now he's gone silent.
Yeah, finally. And I guess we also have to mention his mother, you know? I mean, that's where the story maybe, well, it took a really melodramatic turn. I mean, it seemed to drive another sort of cycle of international news headlines. This has been obviously a terrible story for Spain in terms of its global image. And people sort of loved this sort of nearly stereotypical Spanish melodrama when his mother locked herself in a church and went on hunger strike. I mean, it is just absurd behavior. What's going on there?
Yeah, his mom did lock herself inside a church in desperation. She's now in hospital. So she went on hunger strike for 3 days. She's now in hospital and has abandoned her hunger strike. And there's been a sort of a lot of drama around this sort of story of Rubiales' mother as a side story. You know, it's caused quite a lot of people within the town to come out and show their support too. And there was even one woman she's been living in Spain for, I think, 9 years. She's French. And she actually decided to try and non-consensually kiss a reporter to demonstrate that actually this was just perfectly fine behavior. And I believe she even went as far as trying to grab his crotch, and the reporter naturally didn't want to be part of the story, so tried to withdraw from the situation. But that's the story today, basically. So that's the story within the Spanish media. I don't know if actually it's reached international media so far, but there is certainly this narrative that Spain is Like you're saying, you know, a little bit of a sort of Pedro Almodovar style, you know, melodramatic kind of place. It's unfortunate that the international media has been presenting it that way. I mean, what have you seen, Owen?
That's the thing is, I mean, I for me, and I tweeted about it during the week. One of the things that for me it showed was his desperation and the desperation of this family, like shameless desperation of very privileged elements in Spanish society. I mean, this is the fact that he can't, you know, he should have owned up to what he did at the very beginning. And unfortunately, every sexist, machista trope has now come out against Jenny Hermosa. You know, Rubiales has since released a video of the players celebrating, which I think, you know, shows Jenny Hermoso celebrating on the plane on the way home. Well, if she was, happy and able to enjoy it afterwards, nothing could have happened. I mean, it's obviously just not true. But it's every stereotype about what is consent, what isn't. I mean, the French woman, obviously the difference is the French woman in Motril isn't the boss of that reporter, for one thing. It's not there isn't the same sort of imbalance in terms of gender either. I think it is a problem the way it's been framed internationally, that when you have the focus on the melodrama, it takes away from the underlying issues. And one of the underlying issues, and maybe we can talk about this, is the fact that Spain has a very strong feminist movement and that there was a strong popular backlash to this, which, you know, Rubiales, I think initially, he wanted to wait it out. He thought this thing would blow over. I mean, the fact that the Spanish FA also released a statement in the name of Jenny Hermoso, which she did not write and she did not okay the day of the World Cup final. I mean, you know, the litany of the tactics they've used to try and downplay this and avoid taking responsibility, I think, obviously speaks volumes to the underlining rot and corruption and machismo within the Football Federation. I think at the same time, we've seen protests, we've seen, you know, it's clear the social majority, I think, in Spain are horrified by these actions. So I think it goes both ways.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, in some circumstances, perhaps the way that the institutions have played this may have worked in the past, or perhaps in other contexts, or perhaps even in other countries. But what they really did is underestimate Spain's feminist movements.
Yeah.
You know, which are a really long, you know, really well-established historical feminist movements, you know, that were really born very quickly after the dictatorship. And, you know, we're on the global map for many progressive actions over the years. You know, for example, Spain was one of the first countries in the world to legalize same-sex marriage. We were the first country in Europe to have a menstrual leave law. We've got equal parental leave between men and women. And also we have a Ministry of Feminism, which has pioneered progressive legislation on rape, gender violence, and equal pay. I mean, absolutely, there is still monumental work to be done in Spain to eradicate sexism from the workplace, from the street, you know, from the home. But I still think too little credit has been given to Spain's widespread feminist movements in the Rubiales case. And if it wasn't for women and men and others taking to the streets and really mobilizing en masse throughout the whole country, I don't think that the Rubiales case would ever have exploded like it has. And we can also see that Rubiales himself really underestimated this. And I just don't think that people in Spain, well, I would go as far as saying Spain as a country, I don't think Spain as a country and a society will stop and will become silent at all until this case is resolved.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Spain is a very polarized society as well. And, you know, we saw it in the recent elections. I mean, I think one of the key ideas around which the extreme right mobilizes in Spain is anti-feminism. No, Vox has a very strong anti-feminist, anti-LGBT discourse. And it does work as a mobilizer particularly, you know, to get out the sort of most reactionary elements in Spanish society. We're seeing on both sides. No, I think you're right. I think part of Rubiales' reaction and, you know, the antics of his mother, etc., it as much reflects the fact that he's on the defensive now. Like, you know, he is not going to be able to continue in his job. I think that's pretty clear. As you were saying, the government is against him. You know, FIFA have now suspended him. You know, there's no way he can now continue in his job. But at the same time, we are seeing a certain backlash from the right We're seeing right-wing journalists coming out now defending him. That, yeah, again, it was only a peck. Or, you know, for example, the Madrid regional premier, the regional governor, Isabel Ayuso, came out and said, you know, we're living in a moment when, you know, just to be a man is to be criminalized, etc. She said that today. You know, she came out the other day and said, for example, the international media are concentrating on Rubiales, but why aren't they saying anything about the Catalan separatists, their protests during the Gira, the cycling race in Barcelona? I mean, as in the boycott of this sporting event is the same as a potential sexual assault by the president of the Football Association. I mean, these type of false equivalences. So we are in a situation in which I do think this is again shown, you know, the strength of the feminist movements in Spain, the bravery of the football team. You know, we have to remember that the Spanish Women's Football League went on strike only a few years ago to get better pay and conditions, minimum. You know, basically they were only looking for minimum wage. You know, these are world-class athletes, professional athletes. They've now, you know, 5 years later after that strike, they've now won the World Cup. So they have had to face real adversity. The wider feminist movement in Spain is very powerful. But Spain is also, there is also a strong reactionary right wing in Spain. Rubiales' discourse and the fact that it does find an audience within Spain is representative of that right wing constituency. But look, we're living in the moments of Boris Johnson and Trump. I mean, you know, these type of sexist discourses find audiences in other countries as well. Spain is hardly an exception in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think it's quite easy for the mainstream media, certainly the English speaking media, to sort of look at Spain as a bit of a sort of old fashioned country. Yeah, for sure. We had a dictatorship here until, 45 or something years ago, 43 years ago. So, you know, there has been a lot of work done in that time. And, you know, Spain is one of the most progressive countries in the world. And, you know, like you're saying, the women's football team have been fighting and complaining about certain things, you know, quite a lot for many years now. And I would say that Spain is, you know, on par, if not more progressive than many sort of Northern European countries in this way, certainly on feminism. I mean, talking about sports as well, you know, women's sports and women's football is finally getting a spotlight in the context of women's issues in general. For example, you know, running with breasts, you know, that's not that easy. You need a very intense sports bra, and that's also quite painful. You know, how does menstruation affect your performance physically? What can be done about that? Do we have enough scientific research into that? Well, the answer is no. You know, can we also talk about labor rights too in terms of women's football? And, you know, can those, you know, can the performance be, you know, fit around things that affect women and that don't affect males? And these things are being talked about sort of quite a lot, but I do think that the Rubiales case has also amplified this too, on top of course, the World Cup. You know, the Spain winning the Women's World Cup as well has amplified these issues. And then the Rubiales case has amplified these issues. So it's all sort of coming together. And, you know, for sure, there is a right-wing narrative. There is always going to be a right-wing narrative. But it also does kind of depend on the media that you read. There is just such a collective agreement around the fact that what Rubiales did was wrong, and also around the fact that Spain winning the Women's World Cup was just fantastic for Spain.
Yeah, I was talking about this with a previous guest a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, I mean, it is interesting how little attention, for example, Vox and some right-wing politicians paid towards the World Cup winning team. You know, I think Abascal put out one tweet in the final or something like that, but apart from that, had pretty much ignored it. I mean, I was wondering, could you talk a little bit about, I guess, the slogan now that's emerged in the last week?
It's over.
It's over. It's over. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, exactly. So I was wondering, yeah, could you talk about this slogan? What does it mean? It is over. What does this slogan represent and mean in this context?
Well, I suppose it means sort of that, you know, we've had enough. Exactly. Women have had enough. We're not continuing like this anymore. We're not putting up with this anymore. You know, I think it's being coined by international media as Spain's Me Too moment. Mm. which I think is probably a bit unfair, really, because I feel like, you know, that Me Too moment has already existed. I feel like at the moment, this is perhaps just another moment for Spain, just as part of an ongoing fight and also win against sort of the elite patriarchy. And, you know, Se Acabó was also chanted so much as well when we were, so I attended the protest on Monday night.
Oh, yeah.
On Callao. Yeah. And the chants were just fantastic. And, you know, it's a new, I would say, potentially the beginning of a new wave of feminism in Spain. You know, we've got new chants now. So if you've ever attended feminist marches in the past, they are very similar chants that, you know, are sort of, you know, repeated year on year and also at every sort of specific occasion, you know, Women's Day or Day Against Gender Violence and so on. But we're seeing new chants emerging now, and that's very exciting. And also something else that I saw on Monday that just was so amazing and felt so good was women were singing the champion song. You know, the Campeona song.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, that song is something you hear a lot sung by men.
Yeah.
And to hear it sung by women, it had a different tone to it. You know, those women's voices, so it all sounded very different. And it was also, you know, it was a protest. So, you know, everybody there was fighting against something. But at the same time, there was this fantastic chant, which was so positive. And so really nice to see a protest bringing together those two things, you know, bringing together, you know, the struggle and the fight against the patriarchy and also the fact that we've just won the World Cup.
Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It brings the two things together. Yeah. I mean, where do you see this going? I mean, in terms of the case as well, I mean, is this, you know, we're in this sort of bizarre standoff still. I mean, yeah, his, as you were saying, his mother has now ended her hunger strike, but where do you see this going? I mean, it does seem the end of the road for Rubiales. And more importantly, what does this mean for the Football Federation going forward? Because again, I think if they kill this story immediately, i.e. if he had resigned in the first couple of days or come out and just, you know, completely apologize, etc., maybe the story wouldn't have had the legs it had. But it's now turned into this huge international scandal, is receiving global attention for Spain as a country, etc., and probably the consequences for the Football Federation, for Spanish football, are going to be much more wide-ranging than if he had resigned, you know, 10 days ago.
I think we all know where it's going. You know, he's out.
Yeah.
His career exactly. Is dead.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
And I also think that this probably means a big reorganization of women's sport in general. You know, when I was watching the match, you know, I was really surprised. Like, I hadn't quite realized it, but when I was watching, I was like, oh, hang on. England has a female coach and Spain has a male coach. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, part of me hopes that England wins because then that shows that the female coach won, not the male coach. And I'm not saying that, you know, there needs to be a female coach in all women's matches or that Spain needs a female coach, but it really struck me. And then, you know, looking into a bit further, you realize that actually the vast majority, if not all, of the staff behind the Women's World Cup team are men. Mm. And obviously that's not the case for the men's team. It's not all women's staff behind the men's team. So there we have a perfect example of something that very much needs to change.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, it was sort of an incredible thing where they won despite their coach. I mean, they basically seemed to shut the coach out during the World Cup. And, you know, in that sense, quite an incredible achievement. Normally when you have, again, I guess I'm thinking more men's football, but, you know, when you have these sort of meltdowns before international, or, you know, when relations break down between players and coach before a World Cup, normally that means it's going to be a disastrous competition. And in a sense, I think it showed, well, you know, the depth of quality of the Spanish squad and their cohesiveness as a team, that despite the fact that basically they didn't have a coach, or they won despite their coach nearly, no? I mean, I think it's an incredible thing. And he's someone who's never had a job outside the Spanish Federation, Football Federation, you know, it's completely, you know, enchufado, etc. And in terms of like women's football, I mean, how as a generational thing, it seems to have really taken off in Spain, particularly in the last sort of 5-10 years. You now see stadiums, like, you know, just completely full stadiums for big matches. Do you think must be a turning point for women's football as well, but also 20 years ago or whatever? I mean, you would have had a situation where they didn't have these type of opportunities. Now it does look like women's sport and women's football in particular is really taking off.
Yeah, I mean, if you just look at some of the players in the Spain team, you know, they talk about how they began their football career, and some of them were not permitted to play football, or some of them started off in boys' teams. So, you know, and the players, some of them are just in the early 20s. So we're talking just 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And of course, that is still the case today. There is not a lot to do. You know, there are not a lot of opportunities for young girls to play football in necessarily a safe space. And by safe space, I don't just mean, you know, against potential sexual abuse, but also, you know, physically as well. You know, I remember, you know, being forced to play football with boys when I was younger and ended up with a bloody nose.
Okay.
And that would never have happened if it was just with all girls, for example. So perhaps times have changed, but it's still sort of, you know, I'm still aware of it. And I'm sure that a lot of young girls are still aware of that sort of thing. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, sorry. And the wider issue, because obviously one of the people who's becoming again quite prominent in the last week is the acting equality minister, Irene Montero, who I guess was one of the sort of champions of the new sexual consent law in Spain, the only yes is yes law. I mean, this has obviously been a major issue just in Spain more generally. I mean, for the last, obviously since the La Manada case, was it maybe 5 or 6 years ago in San Fermines in Pamplona? You know, it was one of the initial demands, obviously, of Spain's, the latest wave of feminist mobilizations in Spain. You know, you had the huge protests when we had the verdicts for that case. Then obviously with the current coalition, one of their priorities around the equality agenda was this new sexual consent law, which then there was this huge controversy last year around a potential error in the law or the way that the judiciary were reading the law and where, you know, who was responsible for that. But this has been one of the core demands of the Spanish feminist movement for the last number of years. So yeah, I guess how do you, obviously this is in a sense brought this back up again. I mean, this is an example of non-consensual sexual conduct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, one of the chants on Monday night was Solo CSC.
Yeah.
Again and again. And Yolanda Diaz was there and Irene Montero was there as well. And a lot of the politicians were there too. And, you know, they are very much the champions of this, this law, even though it was obviously very controversial and got a lot of backlash. But yeah, it's definitely brought it back into the spotlight. And that's a good thing. You know, it's, even though it was very controversial at the time, you know, I guess that Spanish society is sort of getting used to the idea of it being there and that it's probably going to stick around for a while. And, you know, let's actually start to really think about what it looks like in practice. And here we have an example, a very public example of what that law can actually do. I suppose that actually Spanish government may well be using that law in the case against Rubiales.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's true. The police have opened, or the prosecutor's office have opened an investigation, I believe. So yeah, I mean, I think it is an interesting thing because the Socialist Party, the major party of government, I think their reaction to that controversy around sentencing, etc., was, I think it speaks a lot to their commitments maybe, but was basically, let's just roll this back. You know, this is going to hurt us electorally. And it is true that I guess the left, while acknowledging that there was an issue there, wanted to try and do more and, you know, maintain the harsh of the law, even if there needed to be certain modifications to do with sentencing, etc. So, I mean, that's the thing. I think what has been lost in a lot of the international coverage, and maybe, look, international coverage is always going to, you know, of any country is always going to be simplified. We've talked about that before in this podcast. But I think one of the things that has been lost within the international coverage of this case is all these issues. I mean, these are very live political and social issues in the country. It's not to do with mother, you know, stereotypical Spanish mothers locking themselves in churches. It's to do with social struggle, really, you know, really life and death issues for millions of women.
Yes, I really hope that the world just starts taking Spain a little bit more seriously. after all of this. You know, what's happened here is Rubiales is very much being held to account across the board, you know, by the public, by the government, by, you know, his own workplace, you know, by everybody just talking about it in a bar. You know, there is absolutely no way that Rubiales can get away with this, or that other people doing the same thing can get away with something like this in the future. You know, Spain is very much aware that this is wrong and not going to let this go. And this is my personal opinion, but I do think that Spain is a feminist society. Even though there are some people who behave badly and do commit terrible sexual abuses, I think that it's very, you really have to be living in a cave to not be aware that there is a huge movement trying to tell you that what you are doing is wrong, or trying to educate you how to be, you know, well, how to just basically not commit crimes. You know, it's not hard to sort of really, if you want to, you know, improve your behavior, or you want to improve the behavior of your colleagues or your workplace or, you know, society or whatever institution, you know, the information is there, you know, the talks are there, the seminars are there, you know, the laws are there. Just talk to your friends, you know, it's a really current topic. It's pretty obvious stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Spain must have one of the strongest feminist movements in Europe. Obviously, you know, I mean, I would say Spain is still polarized, but I think the elections showed in July that the social majority and the electoral majority in Spain is progressive. And, you know, it's held up now once again, the fifth election in, you know, 7 years, etc. So it's a hard one, because I think the issue is a lot of the entrenched power in Spain, whether it's the judiciary, you know, the football association, etc. You do have a very conservative entrenched power in Spain. And I think that is one of the issues, you know, which there's no easy solution to that. But, you know, I think this is definitely shone a spotlight, and hopefully will force greater accountability within Spanish football and in the hierarchy more general in the Spanish Football Federation.
Mm, yeah, I mean, I think football is a very interesting context for all of this to happen, because football is a very historically working class institution. Even today, most footballers have, well, certainly, you know, the majority of the ones that I've been reading about have come from working class backgrounds. But the staff are, you know, they're nepo babies, you know, and also Rubiales, his dad was the mayor of a local town where his mother ended up locking herself in the church. So, you know, there's so much elitism, so much privilege within the ones who control the institutions. But then increasingly, with football being such a powerful institution in itself, you know, the football players are also able to enter this world and start to challenge it from the working class backgrounds, you know, pushing up and pushing against that glass ceiling of class as well as sort of feminism. And so I think football actually has been a very nice context for all of this to happen, because it's almost very transversal, you know, it's just there's so many different things going on right now.
Yeah, no, I think that's a perfect way to sum it up. Yeah, it is. You know, it's is there anything more transversal than Spain winning the World Cup? I mean, it's just, you know, winning the World Cup playing wonderful football. Obviously, maybe, I don't know. I guess, Leah, you were supporting England on the day, but like, yeah.
Actually, I really couldn't decide.
Oh, you couldn't? Okay.
I was just like, I'm going to be happy whoever wins. And I was.
And were you in Madrid or were you in Newcastle for that?
I was watching it in Madrid.
Oh, you were? Okay. Well, that's good. Yeah. Okay, that's great. Yeah. Well, look, this has been a really interesting conversation. Where can our listeners follow you?
So head to my Twitter, Leah Patton, and you can find me there.
Perfect. Well, look, thanks a lot for coming on and explaining the sort of wider context of this issue to us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Owen.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Okay, great.